KSDP 830 AM Sandpoint, K201DA King Cove, KFPS False Pass.
Presidents see a political advantage to taking executive action, regardless of whether it's actually carried out.
2 weeks into the Trump presidency, we try to sort out which moves are a power grab and which are politics as usual. For Sunday, February 2nd, it's All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Scott Detrow. As Secretary of State Marco Rubio visits Panama, we meet the group behind a popular website there that mocks the news.
We are there, so you don't have to be there in the dumpster of information that is Panama.
And OK Campers, rise and shine, and don't forget your booties, because it's cold out there. If you get the movie reference, you know today is Groundhog Day. We head to Punxsutawney to ponder the holiday's greater meaning.
You don't have to cook anything. You don't have to buy anybody gifts. You wake up, the rat comes out of the hole, poof, it's done.
Those stories and much more after this newscast.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Janine Herbst. President Trump's decision to impose tariffs on Canada, Mexico, and China got an immediate reaction. Canada and Mexico are planning retaliatory tariffs, and China says it will file a lawsuit with the World Trade Organization. The Trump administration says it wants China to do more to cut the supply of synthetic opioid fentanyl. NPR's John Ruwich has more.
China's foreign ministry says it's strongly dissatisfied with the new tariffs and resolutely opposes them. It says Beijing will take necessary countermeasures to, quote, firmly safeguard China's legitimate rights and interests. It stopped short of saying what those measures would be. Experts say many of the precursor chemicals for fentanyl flow from China to Mexico, where they're combined in underground labs to make the drug. Beijing says it's taken steps to stop trade in those chemicals as part of what it calls extensive anti-drug cooperation with the United States. The foreign ministry says the new unilateral tariffs violate World Trade Organization rules, and they will inevitably undermine future cooperation against drugs. John Ruwich, NPR News, Beijing.
A U.S. Marine battalion has landed at the U.S. Naval Base in Guantanamo Bay, Cuba this weekend. The Defense Department says the Marines will expand a facility meant to hold migrants detained in the U.S. NPR's Luke Garrett has more.
President Donald Trump wants to send 30,000 migrants to Guantanamo, a facility that's held at most 800 people. On Sunday, Department of Homeland Security Secretary Kristi Noem told NBC News that the facility is, quote, building out some capacity.
We appreciate the partnership of the DOD in getting that up to the level that it needs to get to in order to facilitate this repatriation of people back to their country.
Guantanamo Bay is widely known for its military detention camp that's held terrorism suspects following the attacks on September 11, 2001. When asked, Noem said it was not the plan to hold migrants at Guantanamo indefinitely, but rather to have a process that follows the law. Luke Garrett, NPR News, Washington.
In Washington, family members of the victims of the mid-air plane crash with an Army helicopter last week near Reagan National Airport visited the crash site this morning, commemorating the 67 people who died. Washington, D.C. Fire Chief John Donnelly says the remains of nearly all have been recovered.
So far, 55 victims have been positively identified from this this accident.
The search for the remaining 12 in the Potomac River continues. The Army Corps of Engineers is expected to begin removing the debris from the river tomorrow. The Corps says they will start with the removal of the larger remnants of the jet, and that's expected to take days. They will then remove the Black Hawk helicopter. The National Transportation Safety Board is still analyzing the flight and data recorders, and the search for the cause continues. You're listening to NPR News from Washington. Winters are getting warmer around the country with climate change. A new study shows that's helping rat populations increase in several U.S. cities. NPR's Lauren Sommer has more.
Humans do a lot to help rats in cities. We leave out food and trash. We provide shelter in our buildings and sewers. We've also been making the climate warmer as we burn fossil fuels. A study in the journal Science Advances finds that's one reason rat populations are growing. When it's cold, rats spend less time foraging for food above ground. But winters are getting shorter, which could be giving them more time to find that extra slice of pizza and make more baby rats. Experts say it's just one more reason cities need to focus on solutions to better manage trash. Lauren Sommer, NPR News.
Today is Groundhog Day, and the famous groundhog in Pennsylvania says we should get ready for more winter weather. NPR's Bill Chappell has more.
Punxsutawney Phil emerged from his burrow at daybreak, cheered by what organizers said was the largest crowd ever at Gobbler's Knob, the hillside where this tradition has taken place since 1887. Then the Groundhog Club's Dan McGinley recited the groundhog's message.
There's a shadow up here. Get ready for 6 more weeks of winter this year.
The crowd happily endured hours of cold, but the forecast drew some boos. Bill Chappell, NPR News, Punxsutawney.
U.S. futures contracts are trading lower at this hour on word of Trump's tariffs on Canada, Mexico, and China. Dow futures down 1.2%. NASDAQ futures are down 2.2%. S&P 500 futures also lower. This is NPR.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations. Other contributors include the William T. Grant Foundation, supporting research to improve the lives of young people. Online at WTGrantFoundation.org. And listeners like you who donate to this NPR station.
It's All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Scott Detrow. Here is one view of what's been happening in the U.S. government over the past 2 weeks.
We are in the midst of a sweeping authoritarian power grab that has never been witnessed in the lifetime of anyone standing here right now.
That is Democratic Senator Jeff Merkley of Oregon speaking on Tuesday. He ticked off the actions President Trump has taken so far during the start of his term.
The inspector generals being fired.
Trump fired the watchdogs who monitor federal agencies en masse on a Friday night, ignoring a law that requires him to give Congress 30 days notice and a reason.
Memos going out telling government workers to spy on government workers to see if anyone is overly sympathetic to the idea of diversity.
That directive asked employees to report any colleagues trying to get around President Trump's order aimed at ending federal diversity, equity, and inclusion programs. And then, Merkley brought up the memo that ordered a broad pause on federal loans and grants.
We have Trump saying, I'm going to steal the power of the purse allocated in the Constitution to Congress, and I'm going to take it for myself.
The memo was rescinded on Wednesday, though the White House says it still intends to cut federal funding. It's now tied up in court. Merkley described all of this in stark terms.
That is a constitutional crisis.
The Constitution, of course, has checks and balances built in. But the legislative branch is controlled by Republicans. Both the House and the Senate are under GOP control. And Republican lawmakers look at Trump's moves differently. North Dakota Senator Kevin Cramer told local radio station KFGO that he's a stickler for the separation of powers. But he told reporters Tuesday that Trump was just testing his own authority.
You know, he's getting some guidance that presidents have more authority than they've traditionally used. Some presidents have used a lot of it, some have used less.
And indeed, White House Press Secretary Caroline Levitt said this week that all of Trump's moves are legal. On the funding freeze,
White House counsel's office believes that this is within the president's power to do it, and therefore he's doing it.
Here she is talking about another Trump order, one aimed at ending birthright citizenship, the idea that everyone born in America is an American citizen. It's taken from language in the Constitution.
22 state attorney generals have said that this is unconstitutional. A federal judge has just agreed with their argument. What's the administration's argument for doing away with birthright citizenship?
The folks that you mentioned have a right to have that legal opinion, but it is in disagreement with the legal opinion of this administration.
And that order is likely headed all the way to the U.S. Supreme Court eventually, which has taken a very expansive view lately of presidential power. Republican Senator Jim Risch of Idaho summed up the state of affairs succinctly.
For all of you who haven't noticed, this is a different day in Washington, D.C.
Most presidents want as much power as they can get, and it's not unusual to see them claim authority that they don't, in the end, actually have. We saw it over the last term when former President Joe Biden tried to unilaterally forgive hundreds of billions of dollars in federal student loans.
I will never apologize for helping working Americans and middle-class people as they recover from the pandemic.
Or when Biden announced days before leaving office that the 28th Amendment on gender equality was now the law of the land, which is, of course, not how it works. So are the opening moves of the Trump presidency just a spicier version of the standard playbook or an imminent threat to constitutional government as we know it? We're going to get two different points of view on that now, one from Ronald Prusin, professor emeritus of history at the University of Toronto, and also Kenneth Lawandi, a political scientist at the University of Michigan. He's also the author of the book False Front, The Failed Promise of Presidential Power in a Polarized Age. Welcome to both of you.
Hello.
Thank you. Let's start with you, Ronald. Critics of Trump are sounding all kinds of alarms about the way that he's used executive power. Supporters, again, as we've heard, say this is just what presidents do. Actually, Kenneth, let me start with you. What do you think about that?
So I think you have to be able to hold two ideas in your head at once. Yes, it would be true that if all of these things were carried out and implemented the way that they ostensibly want them to be, it would be a dramatic expansion of presidential power. But then there's this other idea, which is, well, why are they doing this? Like, why are they carrying out actions at the pace that they are, signing 70 or so far? And why do they seem to not care whether or not they'll be invalidated in court or whether they're unworkable or how long they will take? And the answer is because presidents see a political advantage to taking executive action, regardless of whether it's actually carried out. So I think that the concerns are real, and I don't want to downplay the concerns. But if your question is, well, why are they taking this route? It's not always about changing policy.
It's messaging at times as well. Ronald, what do you think about it at this hall?
Well, I mean, in some respects, I would agree with Kenneth just said. That is that political scientists, historians, commentators have been talking about the imperial presidency in the United States for decades at this point. There's been a gradual, substantial, often dramatic expansion of presidential power, certainly, especially since the 1930s onward. That said, I think what we're seeing at the moment is a dramatic expansion of dramatic expansion, particularly intense right now. I guess the equivalent, I would say, of talking about a high tide as opposed to a tsunami. And it is true that there may be a kind of testing process underway here and an image building or image confirming process underway. But there is a context here that makes this particularly threatening, particularly concerning. The context of Trump's own ego, of the nature of the political dynamics right now in terms of Republican power in Congress, and the nature of the Supreme Court's rulings.
Mm-hmm. Kenneth, you said in an interview that the Trump administration, the White House, is almost like an eye of Sauron, and it can focus on some parts of the globe, but they're missing hobbits, you know, elsewhere, and can only really focus in on one part at a time. It's a big federal government. There's a lot of hobbits and, you know, sure, elves and dwarves or whatever else, Middle Earth people you want to put there in this analogy. Do you think, again, a few weeks in, do you think that idea holds up, that a president can really zone in on one or few areas at a time and can't put a massive immediate fingerprint across the federal government?
I think that the fundamental point is that there are bandwidth limitations to any president, right? They've got a couple hundred very close aides who are loyal and competent, and the administrative state is massive, right? That's a really difficult logistical management problem that presidents have been trying to solve for decades. So I think that even the most empowered president is going to have these problems. And in fact, if you look outside the U.S. and you looked at even at dictators who can literally control the life or death of their subordinates, they still have trouble executing their initiatives and getting people to follow their orders. So I think that the point stands. It doesn't necessarily mean that they can only focus on one thing at a time, but I think people need to keep in mind the fundamental human limitations of the challenge that any president faces.
Ronald, what do you see as the most important check and balance at this point?
I think it's has to be, to begin with, I don't see a single one. I think the problem with the context that Trump is operating in is that it is so multifaceted. We're dealing with problems on the congressional front. We're dealing with problems at the Supreme Court. We're dealing with problems at state and local government levels as well. And all of those have to be, going forward, important arenas as far as checks and balances are concerned. In the moment, I'm particularly concerned about the courts, and especially the Supreme Court, given the way in which it has been tilting in recent days. Probably even before that, some of the reactions within Congress, even on some of the confirmation questions, but certainly on various legislative moves as well. That would be a really crucial arena right now.
Kenneth, what about you? What's the most important check and balance right now?
The most important check, if you made me pick one, is the one that they're attempting to smash through, which is an independent, nonpartisan federal workforce. So, I mean, the details on this sometimes get a little bit boring and make people's eyes glaze over, but you have to keep in mind what their fundamental goal is, which is to make most government jobs essentially the property of the sitting president. And that would be a fundamental change to the way that we do government in this country.
A return to really the first century of how the federal government worked.
Well, not even a return to that, because at that time, we did not have 2 million employees, some of whom maintain nuclear weapons or do food inspections. Basically, all we did at that time was the Postal Service, right? So that would be a truly a different world. Some of what public servants do make politicians look bad. They uncover fraud, waste, and abuse. They reveal bad inflation numbers. And if suddenly all of those employees could be fired on a whim by the sitting president or someone who identifies them as opposed to the administration, that's just a totally different world. So I think that that's the last most important check, particularly given the way the courts and Congress has behaved, and it's the one that I'm the most concerned about.
That's Kenneth Lawandy, a political scientist at the University of Michigan and the author of False Front, The Failed Promise of Presidential Power in a Polarized Age, as well as Ronald Prusin, a professor emeritus of history at the University of Toronto. Thanks so much to both of you.
Oh, you're welcome.
Happy to be here. Thanks.
Listening to All Things Considered from NPR News.
I'm Janine Herbst with these headlines. The three countries President Trump put additional tariffs on yesterday say they will retaliate. Trump levied 25% tariffs on Canada and Mexico and 10% on China. They're expected to go into effect on Tuesday. Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu will be in Washington this week to meet with President Trump and senior administration officials at the White House. It's Trump's first meeting with a foreign leader in his second term. It comes as negotiations for the second phase of the ceasefire with Hamas are set to begin this week. And security will be tight in New Orleans next week for the Super Bowl between the Kansas City Chiefs and the Philadelphia Eagles. This after a man drove a truck through a crowd on Bourbon Street on New Year's Day, killing 14 people. I'm Janine Herbst, NPR News in Washington.
Support for NPR comes from this station and from Capital One, offering their premium travel card, Venture X. What's in your wallet? Terms apply. Details at CapitalOne.com. From the estate of Joan B. Kroc, whose bequest serves as an enduring investment in the future of public radio and seeks to help NPR produce programming that meets the highest standards of public service in journalism and cultural expression. And from listeners like you, who donate to this NPR station.
It's All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Scott Detrow. People pay a lot of attention to which country the U.S. Secretary of State visits first. It sends a message. And since President Trump spent a chunk of his inaugural address talking about Panama, we shouldn't be surprised that Secretary of State Marco Rubio flew to Panama City last night, less than 2 weeks after being sworn in. Today, he and Panama's president talked about Trump's desire to take back the Panama Canal, a canal that Panama insists is not for sale. All Things Considered co-host Ari Shapiro is in Panama City. Hey there.
Hi, Scott.
Let's start with this meeting. What's the message that Rubio is trying to send?
Well, according to the State Department, Rubio basically gave an ultimatum to President Jose Raul Mulino. Rubio apparently told Mulino that China's influence over the Panama Canal violates treaties, and Rubio said that unless there are immediate changes, the U.S. will take whatever measures are necessary to protect its rights. To give you just a quick fact check here, Trump has falsely claimed that Chinese soldiers operate the canal. They don't. China doesn't have a military presence here. There are two ports at either end of the canal owned by companies based in Hong Kong. Now, Rubio did not publicly speak about the meeting, but President Mulino did, and he insisted that the canal belongs to Panama and there will be no negotiation about that.
La soberanía de Panamá no está en cuestión. Eso es muy importante.
Panama's sovereignty is not a topic of discussion, he said. That's very important.
Amid all of this, how are Panamanians reacting to this threat from the U.S.?
With protests. I attended a couple of marches that shut down main streets here in Panama City. People burned the American flag. They shouted, "No se vende, se defiende," which means we're not for sale, we'll defend ourselves, but of course it rhymes. But some Panamanians are also responding with humor. I went yesterday to meet three members of the team behind a super popular Panamanian satire group called El Gallinazo. And Scott, I would love to introduce you to them. Their names are Joel Diaz, Jessica Salado, and Esperanza Villalobos. And here's how Jess described their operation.
What El Gallinazo does is that it's like a translator of very important and serious news, but in a Panamanian slang. So everyone can be like informed, but entertained at the same time.
So they're basically meme makers. The name El Gallinazo refers to the black vultures that are all over Panama City. The vulture is definitely not the national bird, but unlike the majestic harpy eagle that is on Panama's crest, the vultures are actually part of people's everyday lives. Joel founded the company 14 years ago, and he says they are scavengers of content.
We are there, so you don't have to be there in the dumpster of information that is Panama.
Esperanza is in her early 20s, and she says her job is to make sure the boomers on staff don't sound out of touch. But she's also a talented illustrator. She recently drew an image of President Trump as a baby pointing at the Panama Canal and crying, "I want that one."
We are not journalists, but people do believe that.
How does that make you feel?
That makes us feel with a huge responsibility. But we have the problem that our media, our content in television and the newspapers, is they use vocabulary that is not translatable to the people that are in the streets.
Can we talk about Marco Rubio?
See?
Yes.
Is this like the Super Bowl for you? How are you feeling about this?
We love content.
We
love controversial content. So Thesaurus is like a gold mine for making content.
We've talked to lots of Panamanians who, when Trump started talking about taking back the canal, they felt shocked or hurt or angry or nationalistic. As comedians, how did you feel when you heard him start talking about taking back the Panama Canal?
We get angry.
But it's also funny, because come on.
I think it's funny because we're looking at our politicians, and we believe that our politicians are low material, IQ, intelligence,
you
whatever.
You think your politicians are dumb?
Yeah. They are. So when these kind of things happen, because when we are talking about our politicians every day, people in the comments are like, yeah, we're nothing like USA. They are intelligent, and we are nothing compared to them. And now when this happens, it's like, yeah. We're the same. We have the same kind of material of politicians. They are funny everywhere. So.
Politicians all around the world share some of the same qualities, is what you're saying?
Right now, yes.
So what did you actually do with that material? Like, what was the meme that you created?
We have this meme that it says, it's from the movie Zoolander.
Zoolander.
Yeah, saying like, Panama is so hot right now. Estamos pegados. Like, we're in the mouth of everyone. We're hot. Yeah.
There's a common expression in the United States, which is, you have to laugh because if you don't, you'll cry. And I wonder if that kind of describes the moment that you all are in right now.
Yeah, yeah, totally.
Also, I find a lot of peace in the chaos when something bad happens to you and you feel like, why me? And then you open a meme and you see the comments and you see like, oh, this is affecting everyone. You find peace when it's a collective thing.
So are you excited for the visit?
Yeah.
Yeah, we are. We don't know what's gonna happen, but we know we'll have content. Because
and that's all that matters.
Sometimes it is.
That is our co-host Ari Shapiro in Panama City. You can tune into All Things Considered tomorrow, where he will be hosting the show from the edge of the Panama Canal. Jesse Eisenberg came up with a story for his new movie, A Real Pain, after seeing an online ad for a tour of Auschwitz. The movie he eventually wrote and directed is about a pair of cousins going back to Poland where their grandmother survived the Holocaust. He said the story was a way to explore all of the themes that are most interesting to him.
How do we reconcile having these kind of privileged lives while also being curious about the horrors of the past? How do we connect to the horrors of the past? And if just the awkwardness of feeling, you know, pissed off that they didn't have our right muffin in the morning time as we then, you know, hitched the bus to go see the site of Gettysburg or Auschwitz or, you know, Rwandan genocide or something. And just the irony of that, that we can feel self-pity when we're smart enough to be aware of how lucky we are.
Jesse Eisenberg is now nominated for an Oscar Best Original Screenplay. He plays David in the movie, a guy who's a variation on the kind of well-meaning but neurotic character Eisenberg has become known for portraying. He chatted about some of his real-life neuroses with Rachel Martin on Wildcard. That's the show where guests answer big questions about their lives pulled from a deck of cards.
One, two, or three?
Two.
What's something you thought was normal about your childhood that you now realize was unusual?
But I don't want to like sounds like I'm asking for pity. I was like a miserable, miserable kid. I was like, I mean, I had great parents. I was a miserable kid for some reason. And I thought it was like normal to that we're all terrified of all things. And now I take my kid to school, you know, which I did 2 hours ago, and they run right into the building smiling. And the first, like, time that happened, which was, like, you know, first day of school, I don't know, 2 years ago, whatever, I was like, what is going on? How do they not know what's inside for them? And so I keep, like, as a parent, like, waiting for, like, the shoe to drop and reality to hit, that actually life is miserable and going to school is miserable. And they just haven't felt that yet. And it's been, I would say, like, overall, like, an unbelievably revelatory experience watching my kid go to school in a different way than I did.
Has watching your kid not suffer from the same kind of anxiety that you did, has that lessened any current or existing anxiety that still travels with you into adulthood?
That's such a great question. No, I think I'm too old to, like, change. So I'm still, like, continuously mystified as to, like, you know, people who seem to, like, walk through the world, like, with their head held high. I don't understand it. In fact, I asked ChatGPT this morning, do you think if I had more circumstantially difficult life experiences, if I'd be more confident asking for a bagel? And ChatGPT said, well, actually, there is a trove of academic evidence to support what you're saying, which is, like, you know, growth through trauma, et cetera. So this is, like, kind of what I'm obsessed about. ChatGPT is a you know, great place to go for these very, you know, human questions.
Oh, that hadn't occurred to me. So it's not that you need validation from artificial intelligence about what you're feeling, but it gives you resources. It basically gives you footnotes.
Yeah. So I got a bagel this morning and I felt too nervous to ask something about the bagel. And then I had this thought, which was that I wonder if I had something more objectively horrifying happen in my life, I'd be much more comfortable asking about the bagel because I wouldn't have this kind of, you know, let's say needless fantastical self-consciousness that for some reason I carry around. And so I said, is there any like literature to support this kind of thing? And it said, yes, there are theories about growth through trauma, which means like that, you know, if you experience something traumatic, you're working on growth in a way that maybe makes you less conscious about these kind of smaller little petty things.
Yeah.
Little did the bagel know it was part of a discussion with
poor little unsuspecting everything bagel. Was it everything? Yeah. What was it?
It was pumpernickel everything. And my initial question was, is pumpernickel healthier than eating a plain bagel? And then I was thinking, oh, I could ask the people behind the counter. But no, it's a grab-and-go fast New York place. They don't want to answer this kind of question. And so then I went to ChatGPT and I said, do you think if I suffered an objective trauma, I would have asked if the pumpernickel was healthier? And it said, yeah, maybe. What a dumb life. What a dumb, dumb life.
Okay, one, two, or three?
One.
One. What's a moment when you remember being brave as a teenager?
Ooh, as a teenager. Give me a second. Well, so in my senior year of high school, I kind of like came into my own a little bit. I transferred to a performing arts high school in New York City, and it was just like, I just became like an adult overnight going there. But the bravest thing I did was probably cut school one day to go see a Broadway matinee of Judgment at Nuremberg, which maybe tells you enough about me, you know, to understand my full personality, which is that, like, you know, my friends and I, well, one friend and I, Graham, and but also, like, the way we were planning it, like a heist at math class in the morning, like, yeah, cool, all right, I'm going to meet you at lunch, and then we're going to get there. I think we can get student tickets for the last row mezzanine. And so, like, our big our big transgression in high school was going to see a Broadway matinee. I'm sure it would have been, like, the kind of thing, like, that if our teachers caught us, they'd be like, oh, my God, you sweet nerds, of course go. That's great. Love you. I'm giving you an A anyway, yeah.
One, two, or three?
Okay, let's do number one.
Number one. What is your best defense against despair?
Oh, wow. I married a woman who has, like, the same values as me. She she's a far better person. She works in social justice, teaches disability justice and awareness and public schools, and her mom ran a domestic violence shelter for 35 years. And so she comes from this kind of world. Yeah. She always just says, okay, so what are you going to do about it? So if I'm like feeling miserable, she's like, okay, so what are you going to do about it? Or I'm like,
what's the action?
So bad. Yeah. What happened to my friend? She always is just like, oh, let's call him now and try to get him a job. My friend didn't get a job. He's struggling. She's like, oh, I know. Oh, you know, I can call my friend Lita. She actually knows somebody who just lost their job here. Maybe they can talk. Maybe they can work together. She just, there's not an instinct in her to wallow in it or to like make it about
ruminate.
Herself.
Yes.
Yes. So I make it about myself. Oh God, I feel so guilty. She's not even aware that she's doing something different than me. It's just the way she's wired. And so I kind of, I look to her all the time and we've been together forever. So like, I it's very easy for me to just kind of just ask her.
I think it's so lovely that you found each other. It seems
I'm lucky. I'm lucky. She is, you know. You know, I'm lucky because I'm not wired for anything good. She's wired to do all this
That's
good stuff.
That's not true, Jesse. That's not. I've known you for an hour, and I don't think you're wired to do nothing good.
No. I'm a thoughtful person, but it doesn't lead to, like, you know, benevolent action. She's just like, she's less contemplative than me. She's just very active and has a good heart.
Ruben Fleischer, your director, said that you were like the kindest person of all time. So, you know.
He's judging me against actors. He said one of the kindest actors.
It's true.
Yeah. Yeah. That's like, you know, the tallest jockey. It's a low bar in my profession.
Jesse Eisenberg's new film, A Real Pain, is out now. Jesse, thank you so much.
Thank you so much for having me.
For a longer version of that conversation, follow NPR's Wildcard Podcast. You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News. President Trump has put a lot of promises into action during his first few weeks on the job. And one thing he talked a lot about running for president, and even in his inaugural address, was undoing much of President Biden's climate agenda and turning the country back to an energy plan centered around fossil fuels. On his first day back in office, Trump withdrew again from the Paris Climate Agreement. He also revoked Biden climate orders, then issued his own to boost fossil fuels. Jeff Brady from NPR's Climate Desk is here to walk through it all. Hey, Jeff.
Hey, Scott.
So let's start with this. What's actually different?
You know, on the ground, not a whole lot is different that most of us would notice. Some climate programs and offshore wind lease sales are on hold. Most of the other orders call on agencies to do some research and then report back. I talked with Amy Myers Jaffe. She directs the Energy, Climate, Justice, and Sustainability Lab at New York University. And she says the country's energy and climate policy is complex. It's not like a speedboat that you can turn around immediately.
It's more like an aircraft carrier, where you've got lots and lots of people on board and lots of equipment and a giant, giant infrastructure. And you turn the wheel and, you know, how long is it before you turn that entire apparatus around in the ocean?
So Jaffe's point is it just doesn't happen fast. We saw this with President Biden's climate policies. Oil drilling actually boomed during his 4 years in office.
And yet Trump is promising and calling to produce even more oil and gas. Economically, is that something oil companies want?
Many do not. That could actually push prices down and make oil and gas less profitable. And fossil fuels, they have a lot more competition now. Think of all the solar panels and wind turbines installed in the past decade. Those don't just stop producing electricity because Trump favors oil and coal.
Okay, let's turn to another big factor here, and that is the fact that so many state and local governments have their own climate policies, have their own climate mandates. How does that affect Trump's effort to try and redirect the whole country back toward fossil fuels?
Trump has little control over those governments. And then there's the private sector. Companies have climate plans of their own that extend out for decades, well beyond Trump's term in office. And there will be legal challenges to Trump's orders. Jackson Ewing directs energy and climate policy at the Duke University Nicholas Institute.
We have a lot of interpreting to do here on both the language and reach of the executive orders themselves, but also the degree to which they are legally viable.
He says until we get more details, you can view these Trump orders more as a message about the administration's intentions.
Okay, and Trump has also begun to pull the U.S. out of the Paris Climate Agreement, which is, of course, something he did in his first term in office before Biden put the U.S. back in it. What's different this time around?
Yeah, and that Paris Agreement, of course, is where countries agreed to limit climate pollution and avoid the worst effects of global warming. That first term, Trump talked a lot more about coal. He even tried to save individual coal-fired power plants, but failed to do that. Ewing says this time the Trump White House does appear more organized. Those orders have been consistent messages focused on fossil fuels, and this Trump administration seems to be moving pretty quickly.
How are other countries responding to all of this?
This is really important because most of the future climate pollution will come from fast-growing countries like China and India. If they follow Trump's lead back toward fossil fuels, it would be very difficult to limit global heating. But that really seems unlikely. They don't have oil and gas reserves like the U.S. does. So while it may seem like President Trump has made a lot of changes already, he really hasn't, because reversing the country and the world's climate accomplishments, it's going to take more than some executive orders.
That is NPR's Jeff Brady. Jeff, thanks so much.
Thank you.
This is NPR News.
The number of Americans who say they use marijuana has more than doubled over the last decade. In many places, it's legal. But finding cannabis products that are safely sourced and properly regulated, well, that can be tricky.
We're talking about a market that lacks transparency and accountability.
So how can consumers figure out how to navigate the marketplace? We'll talk about it on the next morning edition from NPR News.
I'm Janine Herbst with these headlines. Syria's interim president is visiting Saudi Arabia, looking for help to rebuild a country ravaged by more than a decade of war. It's his first foreign trip since becoming the country's new leader. After nearly a week-long freeze, the National Science Foundation says it will resume paying researchers who had received grants. The money was frozen as the agency reviewed how the grants complied with President Trump's new executive orders, especially those targeting DEI. Today's action complies with a temporary restraining order issued Friday, requiring the agency to resume the payments. And at the weekend box office, DreamWorks Animation's Dog Man took the top spot with an estimated $36 million in ticket sales. I'm Janine Herbst, NPR News.
Support for NPR comes from this station and from American Jewish World Service, committed to the fight for human rights, supporting advocates and grassroots organizations worldwide working towards democracy, equity, and justice at ajws.org. From the Walton Family Foundation, working to create access to opportunity for people and communities by tackling tough social and environmental problems. More information is at waltonfamilyfoundation.org. And from the Doris Duke Foundation.
It's All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Scott Detrow. For the past few months, hockey fans in Salt Lake City have been doing something they've never been able to do before, cheering on an NHL team of their own. The relocated Arizona Coyotes have been a huge hit in Utah, despite the fact that the club still doesn't have an official name. For months, the team has been going by
Utah Hockey Club!
The Utah Hockey Club. Maybe not the trendiest choice of name, but in the coming days, the team will be zeroing in on an official name and logo. Belle Fraser is the hockey beat reporter for the Salt Lake Tribune. She's been following all of this and joins us now. Welcome.
Thank you for having me.
I think one of the most interesting things about this is how much the Utah Hockey Club has really stuck with fans. What do you make of that? Any theories why that is?
Yeah, I mean, from day one when this team was acquired from Arizona, fans were at the forefront of this organization. Smith Entertainment Group that acquired the team also owns the NBA's Utah Jazz, and they said they're bringing the NHL to Utah for the community. So they wanted to see the tradition and the hockey culture and the way these new Utah fans would adapt to this team and let that be the guiding force for what they ultimately decide. So Ryan Smith, the team owner, early on in the process, he sent out a tweet and said, everyone, respond to this tweet and give me any names that you want.
So this was intentional. This was, let's bring the fans along for the ride. This wasn't like we saw here in Washington, D.C. with the Washington Commanders. It was almost like the Washington football team was like a buffer zone in between two names. This was different. This was, let's make the fans part of the process.
Yeah, this was very intentional. And Utah Hockey Club, from the beginning, it was always supposed to be temporary to let room for this team to figure it out and the community to figure it out.
But it's a final option. It's stuck around.
Yes, it is a final option. So it made it through the polling. And I think some people are attracted to it because it has ties to the inaugural season. You know, the Utah Hockey Club name and the jerseys will always look back on as a piece of NHL history as the first year in Utah. So I think maybe there's sentimental value to that, but I think fans are more so leaning away from Utah Hockey Club now, but okay, still appreciating that it'll probably be part of the franchise moving forward no matter what.
Something they're definitely not going to be called, the Utah Yetis, which was a fan favorite, but it's not going to happen. What happened there?
Yeah, so on January 9th, the United States Patent and Trademark Office rejected the trademark application for Utah Yetis, and that was rejected for likelihood of confusion, specifically with the Yetis cooler brand, which sells drinkware coolers, but they also have the trademark to use for merchandise, for sweaters, for t-shirts, everything that an NHL team would need to brand its team to the public. Yeti Coolers denied the option for a coexistence deal. They did not want to share their trademark with Utah Hockey Club, so that was the reason that SEG Smith Entertainment Group decided to pivot and move in a different direction and drop the Yeti name in its entirety.
So it's not the Utah Yetis. It might be the Utah Hockey Club. What are the other two finalists?
Utah Hockey Club, Utah Mammoth, and Utah Outlaws are the top three that fans are voting on this week at Delta Center.
As a reporter who covers the team every day, are you allowed to have a favorite or a preference?
I mean, I think so.
What is it?
I think Mammoth is cool.
Yeah.
I like that. I mean, Outlaws, I think, probably has more of a historic tie to Utah in some way, just with the Bandits and that type of thing. But I think Mammoth sounds more like an NHL team. I think the branding for that would probably be easier and perhaps more interesting. But at the end of the day, I don't care. it's the same team, same sport. So.
Yeah, I think I'm with you on Mammoth. That's Belle Frazier, Hockey Beat reporter for the Salt Lake Tribune. Thanks for talking to us.
Yep, thank you.
Nearly a decade ago, French President Emmanuel Macron made a radical commitment to return art and cultural objects to Africa. It set off a moment of reckoning across cultural institutions in Europe, but as Emma Jacobs reports, that long-promised pledge seems to have stalled.
It was a moment that shook up the museum world, in France and beyond.
Pour des restitutions temporaires ou définitives du patrimoine africain en Afrique.
In this 2017 speech in Burkina Faso, French President Emmanuel Macron said that he would make the return of African heritage to the African continent a priority. French museums alone hold around 90,000 objects from Africa, mostly at the Quai Branly in Paris, but also in other national and regional collections. Amélie Salaberry runs the Museum of Angoulême, a 3-hour train ride from Paris. She says Macron's speech and the critical report commissioned in the aftermath were a real wake-up call. As she takes me around her museum, Salaberry points out the collection of African masks and other items, the foundation of which was donated by just one collector in the 1930s, a local doctor. Who, she says, never left France, had never traveled. But Salaberry has little information about how these objects reached France, whether they were fairly purchased or, say, looted after battles.
Tout ça est devenu, en effet, une urgence, une priorité, un axe de travail très fort.
Learning more about the collection's origins has become an urgent priority for museums like Angoulême. But after missing documentation, the biggest hurdle to returns is legislative. Objects in French museum collections belong to the state. They can't be released without Parliament's say-so. Legislation was passed in 2023, making exceptions for human remains and art looted during World War II.
Pour l'instant, les conditions au Parlement n'étaient peut-être pas réunies.
But Claire Chastanier, who works for the Minister of Culture, says her colleagues don't think Parliament is ready to pass legislation on objects from the colonial era.
En attendant, on avait un dossier qui était déjà prêt.
A talking drum from the Ivory Coast, meant to be the first item returned under a wider bill, has been boxed up and ready to ship for over a year. Chastanier says it will now be returned alone because Parliament can't reach a consensus on what comes next. Cédric Crémière, who recently published a book called Beyond Restitutions, says that's partly due to reluctance to confront France's history in Africa.
There are still some people who are... doesn't really want to talk about what really did happen during the colonial period.
But he does see a huge cultural shift within French museums, many of whom are now more prepared to confront difficult questions about the provenance of their collections. Daniel Abidjo, a graduate student from Benin completing a PhD in France, contributed to ongoing research at the Quai Branly. He looked at a group of 3,000 objects gathered from across sub-Saharan Africa by a French scientific expedition in the early 30s.
Une fiche, on peut voir que un objet a été donné.
On paper, Abidjo says, an object may be described as a gift.
Mais si on se pose dans le contexte colonial, on se rend compte au fait que ça a été donné, mais sous pression au fait.
But, he says, within the colonial context, objects may have in fact been gifted under pressure. Still, even if it's agreed an object was obtained illegitimately, it can't be released until Parliament acts. Meanwhile, some African museum professionals express impatience with what they see as a persistent injustice.
Ça fait longtemps que les objets devaient être là. Ils n'auraient jamais dû partir.
El Hadji Malik Ndiaye, curator at the Theodore Monod Museum in Senegal, says objects should have been returned long ago.
Il y a des collections qui sont importantes pour leur point de vue symbolique.
There are collections with important symbolic value for communities and for their identities, which have left behind gaps and empty spaces. Helping people reconnect with their absent heritage, he says, is urgent work, even if, for now, much of it remains in European collections. For NPR News, I'm Emma Jacobs in Paris.
In Punxsutawney, Pennsylvania this morning, at dawn, Phil the groundhog emerged from his tree stump. And surrounded by bearded men in long coats and top hats, the seer of seers, the prognosticator of prognosticators, dared to predict whether we are in store for an early spring or for six more weeks of winter. Tens of thousands of people gathered at Gobbler's Knob for this ritual, and among them was NPR's Bill Chappell. Hey, Bill.
Hi, Scott.
Let's get right to the news. What did Phil predict?
So, as you very accurately described, it's a huge production, and he predicted that there will be six more weeks of winter weather.
How did that go over?
Well, everybody groaned a little. Here's Inner Circle Vice President Dan McGinley. He's also known as Moonshine, because all these guys have like Groundhog Day names as well. So here he is reading the scroll that contains the groundhog forecast.
There's a shadow up here. Get ready for six more weeks of winter this year.
Bill, I love, like, you stay up through the night, you stay out in the cold to cheer, and then you end up booing a groundhog. Like, it's, what generally was the scene like in Punxsutawney? This is a small community in western Pennsylvania, and once a year in early February, it does this fun, bizarre ritual, and the whole country tunes in.
Well, it was a huge party. This year's Groundhog Day fell on a weekend, so they had this kind of on the radar from early. I talked to bar owners who said they were prepping for this for months. One guy who ran a pretty modest-sized pizza place said he was going to probably go through at least six or seven kegs yesterday.
Makes sense.
There's a lot of partying and drinking during the day. Saturday is what we saw. There's a big festival laid out on the square with music acts and crafts, every kind of Punxsutawney Phil merch you could dream of, and some you might have nightmares about.
On one hand, Bill, this sounds like a lot of fun. On the other hand, one could argue that staying out in the cold all night to hear a groundhog predict weather is kind of an odd thing. Like, over the course of reporting this weekend, any sense why people do this?
Traditionally, this was a way to mark the halfway point between the winter solstice and spring equinox. And people do acknowledge Phil doesn't have the actual power to dictate our weather itself and to move the signposts of astronomical spring or something like that. But they want signs of warm weather. You've been seeing more daylight. This is one of the big moments that's almost like a living piece of folklore just being there for it.
And Bill, I guess the movie, we haven't even mentioned the movie yet. We've been focused on the actual thing, the Groundhog Day movie. It's been decades now, but I imagine that took it up another level.
Yeah, you know, the organizers I spoke to said that the movie kind of increased crowds by like 10 times when it came out in 93. But not everybody who lives in Punxsutawney actually goes up to Gobbler's Knob for this. I spoke to Mindy Gross, who was selling really cute felted groundhog figurines. And she says she doesn't go up there, but she really does like Groundhog Day.
This is my favorite holiday. You don't have to cook anything. You don't have to buy anybody gifts. You don't have to even see your in-laws. You wake up. The rat comes out of the hole, poof, it's done.
And that's what it was like being there. The rodent came out. I throw a little more respect on Phil's name. He came out, it was done, and everybody said, poof, it's over. Let's get on these buses and go back into town and have more fun.
NPR's Bill Chappell reporting on Groundhog Day. Thank you so much.
Glad to do it, Scott.
Okay, so it is hard to deny that Groundhog Day is kind of a fun and silly holiday, but NPR's Avery Keatley offers a perspective on why the holiday is unique and important to American culture.
It could be because I'm from Pennsylvania, but Groundhog Day has always felt like kind of a big deal.
A groundhog and his shadow are a very famous pair.
I remember elementary school crafts and projects leading up to Groundhog Day, and learning the folklore tradition of the groundhog seeing his shadow.
Legend decreed that if the sun were shining when he came out of his burrow and he could see his shadow, the groundhog would be frightened and crawl back into his hole for 6 weeks more of winter hibernation.
Even though I grew up far from Punxsutawney, the culture of Groundhog Day was strong. And it was fun. I remember the suspense and excitement over Punxsutawney Phil's predictions and being disappointed if they didn't come true.
Statistically, Phil is only right about 40% of the time. So
as a kid, of course, I was usually hoping for more winter and the chance for more snow days. But as I got older, there was less emphasis on Groundhog Day, less excitement, and a lot fewer places to talk about the turning of the seasons. Even as we heard more and more that our environment was changing.
Climate change intensified the hot and dry conditions.
And almost everywhere on Earth, people experienced 41 additional days of dangerous heat.
Unseasonable weather patterns. And
but at the same time, I was paying more attention to the four seasons, becoming more interested in connections between nature, agriculture, and our shared human history.
The sun follows a prescribed pattern around these stones.
Across the globe, some of our most ancient temples and monuments are directly tied to turning points in the year, like 5,000-year-old Stonehenge, which aligns with the summer and winter solstices. But in the modern world, our connection to the turn of the seasons is fraying, and our holidays often focus more on the world we've created than the world of nature.
Weekly Black Friday deals you can't miss.
And you don't have to wait until Memorial Day.
All December long, come in and enjoy everything 35 to 50% off.
In America, most of our holidays are tied to our national myth-making. We celebrate towering figures like George Washington and Martin Luther King Jr. We commemorate our independence from foreign power and the emancipation of enslaved people. But none of our holidays specifically mark the changing of the seasons. Except for one, Groundhog Day. Roughly halfway between the winter solstice and the spring equinox, Groundhog Day is a time of transition when we can see visible signs of the Earth changing. The sky stays lighter later into the evening and rises earlier in the morning. Migrating birds travel north, and the morning crackles with their songs. Groundhog Day may not be the most glamorous holiday we celebrate in America, but it does play a role that none of our other holidays fulfill. It reminds us that we are tied to the earth, the seasons, and the creatures who live here with us. At a time when the Earth is changing, and our seasons with it, Groundhog Day offers us a chance to participate in one of the oldest human traditions, hoping for brighter days ahead. Avery Keatley, NPR News.
And that is All Things Considered for this Sunday. I'm Scott Detrow. Thank you for listening, and of course, happy Groundhog Day.
Support for NPR comes from the station. And from Indeed, designed to be an end-to-end hiring solution for businesses of all sizes to attract, interview, and hire candidates, all from one platform. Learn more at Indeed.com/NPR. From the Wallace Foundation, working to develop and share practices that can improve learning and enrichment for young people and the vitality of the arts for everyone. Ideas and information at wallacefoundation.org. And from ECMC Foundation at ecmcfoundation.org.
Fiber Plus Internet is now available in Sandpoint and King Cove. GCI offers high-speed internet in your community at the same plans and pricing as in Anchorage. More information is available at gci.com/internet.
Holding hands at midnight, meet the starry sky. Nice work if you can get it, and you can get it if you try. Strolling with the one boy, sighing sigh after sigh. Nice work if you can get it, and you can get it if you try. Just imagine someone waiting at the cottage door, where tomorrow to come one who could ask for anything more. Loving one who loves you, and then taking that